Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a series of blessings and curses, and they're reiterated after this charge by Moses that when the children of Israel come into the land, that they are to put a certain of their number on Mount Gerizim to pronounce blessings on the children of Israel, and a certain number on Mount Ebal to pronounce curses, to make this visual demonstration, something that would stick in their minds, that wouldn't just be audible, but it would be visual. It would be an experience as they come into the land to see that they stand in their lives between the blessings of God and the chastening of God. And that there is, in that place they stand, a place where they decide things, where they yield in obedience or they walk in rebellion, and that a choice of living in blessing or in difficulty was being set before them. As we come to the 28th chapter, God then begins to reiterate some of those blessings in the first 14 verses, and then there are six times as many curses, four times as many, verses 15 to 68. Now, I don't think it's because God is more anxious to curse. I think it's if you have a teenager and you're letting them out with the car for the first time, you may give them certain blessings, but your list of warnings is going to be way longer than your list of blessings as you're giving them, here's the car keys, you know. So I think with God in His love, knowing our nature, knows that we need those parameters of His warnings more desperately than we need Him. You know, His blessings are simple, they're straightforward, they're there for us. And it's remarkable as you read through the beginning of chapter 28, those first 14 verses, He says that in obedience and in hearkening to the Lord and the keeping of His commandments, that their crops would be blessed. Their land would be blessed in regards to their agriculture, that their military endeavors would be blessed, that their enemies would flee before them, that their reputation amongst the other nations of the world would be a reputation that would be wondered at, and that people would wonder after their God. You know, it's remarkable to look at the national blessings that are pronounced upon them, and God says it doesn't have anything to do with how well you can balance your economy. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you make charts on the wall with graphs, and we need to figure this out, and if we invest more here, this will happen. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the amount of weaponry you amass. It doesn't have anything to do with. What it has to do with is if a nation will hearken to me and they will obey me and they'll set their heart toward me to yield my commandments and my instruction, they will be blessed militarily. They'll be blessed agriculturally. They'll be blessed in their homes with their children. They'll be blessed in what their reputation is amongst other people. And how remarkable it is, how simple it is to read through those things and have God all the way through the scripture reiterate that over and over and over. And of course, as we look at our own nation, our problem is not that we can't balance our budget. Our problem is not all of the things that are constantly before us. Our problem is that we have forgotten God as a nation. Somehow we have come to the delusion that we can live without Him, that we can set our own rules, that we can decide the worth of human life without Him, that we can decide morality without Him, that we can decide as a people how we should live, and that we can block God out of all of that and somehow go on our way and see some form of success. And it is a delusion. And in many ways, the problem in this country is not the president, the policymakers. It's you and I. It's our prayer closets. Have we fasted? Have we prayed? Have we sought the Lord? Have we asked for a revival and an awakening? Have we been genuinely light and salt in the lives of unbelievers that are around us? Have we taken every opportunity? Can I stand, I'm speaking myself, stand before the Lord if He catches me up this evening and say, Lord Jesus, I took every single opportunity that You placed in my life to study and to pray and to witness? I can't. I can't say that. I can't say it. I've done as much as I've done, but there's always greater light. There's always, Lord, lead me onward. I always live with a sense of that calling. Lord, deepen me. Lord, make me someone who is more sold out, Lord Jesus, for you, for your purposes. And I bear that. I know you probably feel the same way. And we're not under the law. I mean, Christ has paid the price in full. He relates to us and encourages us and leads us as a shepherd and as a father, as a parent, as a groom does his bride. And yet somehow I know that if the church had been all that it should have been, this nation would be much different. And I think, Lord, one more time, Lord, like the days of Whitfield, Lord, one more time, like the great awakening we saw as we became a nation, one more time, Lord, before judgment falls, let there be a great ingathering. And I know that that can happen. I know that it can happen. So these blessings are pronounced, all contingent upon their obedience, their hearkening to God, their yielding to the one who produces every blessing. They come from God, they come from heaven, not from natural means. Verse 15, he begins to warn. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Now again, Israel was under the law. You and I are not. This is not for you and I to place ourselves under the law in regards to earning God's love or forgiveness, but certainly it is great instruction for us to point us to the place of God's blessing in our present lives as individuals. Verse 16 says, "Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field." And this is for a nation that is not yielding to him. I wonder how much of that is upon us or any. "Cursed shalt be thy basket and thy store," your storehouses. "Cursed shall be the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy land and the increase of thy cattle and thy flocks and thy sheep. Cursed shall be thou be when thou comest in. Cursed shall thou be when thou goest out." Now, verses 16 through 19 are the exact opposite of the blessing stated in verses 3 to 6 earlier in the chapter. They are the exact, you know, like the negative image of the positive picture there. They're the exact opposite of those things that had already been stated. Verse 20 says, "The Lord shall send upon thee cursing, vexation, and rebuke, and all that thou settest thine hand unto for to do, until thou be destroyed, until thou perish quickly, because of the wickedness of thy doings, whereby thou hast forsaken me." So vexation, cursing, it's going to be to try to experience blessing without the Lord, he says, will be frustrating, and it will be a rebuke to you. There's a lesson, God says, in the hardship and the chastening that will come your way. It isn't just that he enjoys making life difficult. It's that he's trying to wake someone that he loves up and say to them, you can't persist in rebellion and expect my blessing upon your life. "The Lord shall make the pestilence cleave unto thee until he have consumed thee from off the land whither thou goest to possess it. The Lord shall smite thee with a consumption, with a fever, and with an inflammation, with extreme burning." None of that sounds good. "With the sword and the fields now, with blasting and with mildew, they shall pursue thee until thou perish. And thy heaven that is over thy head shall be brass, and the earth that is under thee shall be iron," speaking of drought and famine that would come. "The Lord shall make the rain of thy land powder and dust. From heaven shall it come down upon thee until thou be destroyed." And again, how quickly the Lord can get our attention by simply putting his finger on the food chain. And you can have all the Krugerrands in the world stored up. And when there isn't anything to eat, you can suck on your Krugerrands all day long, and they aren't worth anything. The book of Revelation, again, they're trading away a wheelbarrow full of gold for a wheelbarrow full of wheat. You know, a day's wage for a loaf of bread. And the nations of the world at times have seen that kind of condition, and how quickly we remember how fragile we are at a time like that. The Lord shall cause thee to be smitten before thine enemies. Thou shalt go out one way against them, shall flee seven ways before them, and shall be removed unto all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, of course, how remarkable, as you think of the nation of Israel, some of these things are, because this is exactly what happened to them. Thy carcass shall be meat unto the fowls of the air and unto the beasts of the earth. No man shall fray them away. The Lord will smite thee with the botch of Egypt. I don't want that. With emrods, and I want that either. With the scab, with the itch, whereof thou canst not be healed, doesn't sound good. The Lord shall smite thee with madness, and with blindness, and with astonishment of heart. Thou shalt grope at noonday as the blind gropeth in darkness. Thou shalt not prosper in thy ways. Thou shalt be only oppressed and spoiled evermore. No man shall save thee. Thou shalt betroth a wife, and another man shall lie with her. Thou shalt build a house, and thou shalt not dwell therein. Thou shalt plant a vineyard, and shalt not gather the grapes thereof. Thine ox shall be slain before thine eyes, and thou shalt not eat thereof. Thy donkey shall be violently taken away from before thy face, and shall not be restored to thee. Thy sheep shall be given unto thine enemies, and thou shalt have none to rescue them. Thy sons and thy daughters shall be given unto another people. Thine eyes shall look and fail with longing for them all the day long, and there shall be no might in thy hand. Now, again, when considering the history of the nation of Israel being carried to Assyria, being carried to Babylon for their idolatry, for their turning away from the true and living God, for all of the benefits that had come their way. And he's going to talk about that as we get to chapter 29, all the blessings that had come on their lives, all they had seen, all they had witnessed, and still how their hearts were hardened and turned away. The fruit of thy land and of all thy labors shall a nation which thou knowest not eat up. Thou shalt be only oppressed and crushed always, so that thou shalt be mad for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. The Lord shall smite thee in the knees and in the legs with a sore botch that cannot be healed, from the sole of thy foot unto the top of thy head. The Lord shall bring thee and thy king, which thou shalt set over thee, unto a nation. And how this happened when the Babylonians carried them away. Unto a nation which shall which neither thou nor thy fathers have known. And there thou shalt serve other gods of wood and of stone. Now, by the way, look, as we're reading through this, it's pretty depressing as we're reading through this. This hasn't happened to them. God's saying to them, in his love, and there's a warning, and Moses is speaking this, who they venerate and who loves them and whose heart is broken over them because he knows already of their failure from God that would come. You know, this is, I believe, being presented to them with great pathos. And it's the same way that we would warn any of our children and say, if you do this, you're going to get hurt. You know, if you go into the world and you mess with drugs and you mess with immorality, and if you do these things, there's AIDS and there's addiction and there's people that OD on drugs, and we've seen it from within our own borders that have gone out and have touched those things that God has warned them to stay away from because he loved them and wanted them to be safe. And the reason that we would warn our own children, don't play in traffic. Our small children, if you play in traffic, you get run over, you get killed. They think, oh, we're trying to ruin their fun by not letting them play in the street. No. We care so much for their lives. We're trying to say, you know, I work and I spend my whole life to provide a parameter whereby you can be safe. And if you insist on going out there, it's dangerous. You're going to be injured. You're going to be hurt. And I think it's with that kind of pathos that God is giving the warning. They haven't lived this out yet. As depressing as it all sounds, I think God wanted it to sound that way. He wanted it to sound bleak. He wanted to say to them, look, this is a wasteland. If you walk away from me and you turn your heart away from me and you try to live without me, it's a wasteland. And how many times maybe have you done that as a Christian? If you turned away from the Lord and it's almost you live the same life, you drive the same car, you go to the same place, but you live with this great sense of barrenness. and being empty and as futility and as frustrating and there's no fulfillment in it, the very same experiences that you were having when your heart was toward the Lord and you were walking with Him and it seemed so full then, we turn away and we think that there's something that the world has for us that's being withheld by the parameters and the statutes of the Lord, and then we live the same life in complete frustration with barrenness. Well, that's what God's saying. It will be bleak without me. If you turn away, you know, your carcass, he says, will be eaten by the fowls of the air. Now notice, he's saying to them, he doesn't associate them with their carcass. We associate ourselves with our carcass all the time. Again, putting a lot of work into our carcass, painting our carcass, taking our carcass to the gym, doing all kinds of things to our carcass. You know, we associate greatly with our carcass. And God's able to look at them and know that ultimately they're spiritual beings. Ultimately, there's some greater thing that lives within the shell, within the carcass. Ultimately, there is some eternal purpose that He is working out in regards to the nation of Israel and ultimately the coming of Christ and then the church. And He's able to look at them and say to them, you know, ultimately there is a much greater purpose for you. And the quest of man is not to, again, find freedom, but it's to find the right master. Every human being, whether he knows it or not, is looking to be mastered by the right thing. And we end up mastered by drugs, or mastered by sex, or mastered by pornography, or mastered by money, or by sin, or by pleasure, or by, you know, one thing or another. And ultimately, because our being is truly spiritual, and this is just a carcass, there is something within us that is never satisfied until we are reunited with the God who made us, who understands ultimately the purpose for our lives, who when we die will bring our soul and our spirit to heaven until the resurrection of the body and the transformation of this mortal and this corruption. And he's speaking, you know, to them and saying, your carcass will be eaten by the birds. You know, to we listen, they go, ooh, man, that's mean. That's because we associate ourselves with our carcasses. No, he's speaking to the man, to the woman, to the inner person. And he's saying, in all of your physical existence, all that you experience, the world that I created, the trees that I put in place, I'm the one who made the trees bearing their fruit after their kind, all of these things, all were just put in place for you. It was placed there because it was the world that I would put you into. And it all functions a certain way by my decree. I've set the stars in their places, I've set the moon and the planets and everything where they are, and I've placed you into this, and it is in conjunction with me, when your life is aligned the way it should be aligned, that all of these things then function the way they were supposed to function in the first place. If you think you can turn away from me and serve other gods and be rebellious and turn away, you'll find that in all of those things there is only barrenness and emptiness and bleakness and chastening. Because all of those things can only be what they're supposed to be when they are seen and experienced in conjunction with your fellowship and obedience with me. Outside of that, there's nothing. And that's the warning that he's given to them and challenging them about their lives without him. Verse 35, the Lord shall smite thee in the knees and the legs with the botch and so forth. From the sole of thy foot to the top of the head, the Lord shall bring thee and thy king, which thou shalt set over thee, into a nation neither thou nor thy fathers have known, and there thou shalt serve other gods of wood and stone, how it happened in Babylon and Assyria. Thou shalt become an astonishment and a proverb and a byword among all the nations whither the Lord shall lead thee. And how the wandering Jew, anti-Semitism, has spread around the world. Oh, it's satanic. It's ungodly. God still has a covenant with Abraham and with the Jewish people. But how they become a byword all through the world. Thou shalt carry much seed out into the field and shall gather but little in, for the locust shall consume it. Thou shalt plant vineyards and dress them, but shalt neither drink of the wine nor gather of the grapes, for the worms shall eat them. Thou shalt have olive trees throughout all thy coasts, but thou shalt not anoint thyself with oil, for thine olive shall cast its fruit. Thou shalt beget sons and daughters, but thou shalt not enjoy them, for they shall go into captivity. Thy trees and thy fruit and thy land, the locust shall consume. The stranger, the foreigner that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend unto thee, and thou shalt not lend unto him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. How we've seen that with the American economy. It's remarkable. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee, and overtake thee till thou be destroyed. Notice, because thou hearkenest not unto the voice of the Lord thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded thee. And they shall be upon thee for a sign and a wonder, and upon thy seed forever. Here it is, because thou servest not the Lord thy God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart for abundance of all things. Isn't it so simple? You know, we would look at all of these things with the economy and with the military and with the agriculture and with all of the gross national product and our exportation and our importation and our sales and all of these things and the interest rate and all that's going on. And we would have, you know, we have all kinds of meetings all over the country. And this is what we need to do. And if we do our investments here, and the Fortune 500 is talking about this, and Greenspan's talking about this, and this is that, and the military needs more money for this, and all of these things, could it really be that if our whole nation sought God and got on its knees, that his blessing would be upon us again? Could it really be that simple? Could it really be that he had given this land to our forefathers in the beginning, who were men and women who lived according to godly principles? Oh, there were sinners, they weren't perfect. But could it really be? Boy, it would sure be a fun experiment to see, wouldn't it? To see what God might do if we stand in the place that he tells us to stand in and walk in the place that he tells us to walk in and make our fellowship and our service to him a priority. No longer to be a debtor to other nations. That's what it says. No longer to have to fear our enemies. No longer to have to worry about all of this strange weather. People saying that all year this year, weren't they? You hear people say that? Ain't the weather strange? You hear anybody say that? Did you say that? Ain't this weird weather? I think we should look to heaven and say, Lord, this is weird weather. Are you speaking? We make things so complicated, don't we? Therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies, which the Lord shall send against thee, in hunger and in thirst and in nakedness and in want of all things, shall put a yoke of iron upon thy neck until he have destroyed thee. And the Lord shall bring a nation against thee from the far end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flieth. Interesting, both Babylon and Assyria and Rome had the eagle in some of their standards and their flags. A nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young. And he shall eat the fruit of thy cattle and the fruit of thy land until thou be destroyed, which also shall not leave thee either grain nor wine nor oil or the increase of thy cattle or thy flocks or thy sheep until he have destroyed thee. And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates until thy high-fenced walls come down where, notice, wherein thou trustest. The Lord's saying you're trusting in the wrong. You know, if you had been trusting in me, there'd be no enemy getting an advantage over you. But because you've forgotten the Lord and you're trusting in your high walls and in your own fortresses, he says you'll be shut up within your gates until your high-fenced walls come down wherein you trust throughout all thy land. And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates throughout all thy land which the Lord thy God hath given thee. Now he says, thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, turning to cannibalism, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters which the Lord thy God hath given thee, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemies shall distress thee. Now, by the way, you see it fulfilled by the Assyrians. We have the descriptions in 2 Corinthians of those that were trapped in the city, They're selling a container of dungs, of dove's dung, for food. Fighting over, you know, coming to the king and saying, oh, this woman lied to me. She said if we killed our babies, we'd eat her baby first, then we'd eat my baby, and we killed my baby and ate it. Now she won't kill her baby and eat it. And the king just throws his hands up to heaven and says, Lord. It was like that in the Babylonian besiegements. It was like that when Titus Vespasian besieged Jerusalem. We have the historic records. And God clearly spoke and said, if you walk with me, if you serve me, my blessing will be on your life. Only need 14 verses. It's so plain. And then he reiterates with this long challenge, the difficulties, and they're all prophetic, that would come if they would turn away and worship other gods, and how literally they're fulfilled. So that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eyes shall be evil towards his brother and towards the wife of his bosom, toward the remnant of his children. In other words, he'll be so hungry, he'll be looking at you thinking, You know, I can't help it. I get that image in my mind of two guys that are stranded on a desert island, and the one guy's looking at the other guy and he looks like a big drumstick, you know. And the other guy's looking at the other guy and he looks like a hot dog steaming in a bun, you know. Do you ever see that? That's what he's saying. Your eye shall be evil towards your brother, towards your spouse. You'd be so hungry, you'd be looking at your buddy going, you don't look that bad. So that he will not give to any of them the flesh of his children, whom he shall eat. Because he hath nothing left in the siege and in the straitness wherewith the enemy shall distress thee in all thy gains. The tender and delicate woman among you that was used to prosperity and living high, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for the delicateness and tenderness, her eye shall be evil towards her husband of her bosom, and toward her son and toward her daughter. And toward her young one that cometh out from between her feet, and toward her children which she shall bear, for she shall eat them for want of all things secretly in the siege and straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in thy gates. If thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear this glorious and fearful name, the Lord thy God, then the Lord will make thy plagues wonderful or awesome, and the plagues of thy seed, even great plagues, and of long continuance, and of sore sickness, and long continuance. Moreover, he will bring upon thee all the diseases of Egypt, which thou wast afraid of, and they shall cleave unto thee. Also every sickness and every plague, which is not written in the book of this law, them. That's encouraging. Even things we haven't heard of, he's going to bring upon us. He will bring upon thee until thou be destroyed. And ye shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitude. He had fulfilled that promise to Abraham, because thou wouldest not obey the voice of the Lord thy God. Now, you see in all of this, and he will say it in other places, he'll say, look, you know, remember, I judge these nations, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, that were evil. And because of their evil, I judged them, and I used you as my chastening instrument, as my rod of judgment. And then God is saying, so how do you then expect to come into the land and worship other gods and act the same way they acted and then to escape my judgment? That would be a double standard. God says that's not going to happen. If you'll simply walk with me and you'll yield to me. And again, as we step back and we look at the history, this is something that's never happened from the beginning of recorded history. And God says that. This is something that's never happened since man was on the earth, he would say to them. You know, that a God such as me would make a people like you his own people. And here he had come and delivered them from Egypt and parted the Red Sea and the remarkable things he did and led them through the wilderness. And then he would say to them, what I want from you is integrity. What I want from you is morality. What I want from you is for you to stand with your head and shoulders above all of the heathen that are around you, with all of their cruel and ungodly pagan practices. I want something better for you. I want life. I want prosperity. I want strength. I want integrity. You know, just what an incredible thing for God to set them aside and say those things to them. But then the warnings must come. If you turn away, if you do these things, you'll find yourself in the same position as those who have been destroyed because of them. It shall come to pass, verse 63, that as the Lord rejoiced over you to do you good, to multiply you, so the Lord will rejoice over you to destroy you and to bring you to nothing. And you shall be plucked from off the land whither thou goest to possess it. And the Lord shall scatter thee among all people from one end of earth unto the other. And there you shall serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even of wood and of stone. And among these nations, plural, shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. All because they're disconnected from their Creator and their Lord. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee. Thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have no assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, "Oh, I would to God that it was evening. I'm tired of this day." And at evening you shall say, "Oh, I wished it was morning. I'm afraid of the night, because of the fear in thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and with the sight of thy eyes which thou shalt see. And the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spake unto thee. Thou shalt see it no more again, and there you shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen, and no man shall buy thee." Now, remarkable as we look to this, thou shalt be sold in Egypt, it says, unto thine enemies. Titus Vespasian, when he besieged Jerusalem, over 1 million people ended up dead, close to 1.5 million. He led 97,000 people away slaves. 17,000 of those were put on ships and taken to Egypt and sold on the auction blocks. Exactly as the Lord says here, you will be taken on ships to Egypt and sold. You know, here is God standing back, who's able, you know, he's the one who is and who was and who is to come. He sees the end from the beginning, and he's able to say to them, this is the course of your history. Throughout these thousands of years, at any point in time as a people, if your hearts are turned toward me and you're obedient and you walk in my commandments, you will experience blessing. You know, as he looks, he says, I can see that under Joshua. I can see it under David. I can see it under Solomon. But I see trouble under Jeroboam. I see trouble under Manasseh. I see trouble under Jehoiakim. I see no king and a corrupt priesthood in the days of Christ. I see you being carried away and sold on the auction block in Egypt, taken there by ships. You know how remarkably that God was able to stand back and just tell them out the history of the world from his perspective and what would take place to them because of their turning away. No mistake about it. There's no threat in all of this. I think a brokenheartedness of a father who was able to see the future of his children and to know in his heart that they would suffer distress and suffering because of the rebellion and turning away. And I think for any father to tell that story out to his children ahead of time, it would be with tears and brokenheartedness. And I'm sure it is as this takes place. The challenge then, here in chapter 29, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. Now they're in view of Jericho, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Now he's reiterated these blessings and these cursings. And Moses called unto all of Israel and said unto them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, unto Pharaoh, and unto all his servants, and unto all his land. You know, he says, that I can bring a blessing or a curse. You were eyewitnesses. You saw me destroy the greatest nation in the world in their godlessness. You know that I'm able to bring these things to pass. The great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs, and those great miracles. Yet the Lord hath not given you a heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day. Now, Jesus would say something very similar. he would say, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear." In the book of Revelation, it would say, "Let him who has ears hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Let him," singular, speaking to individuals, "hear what the Spirit is saying," present tense, that is, has been saying, is saying, and will say today, what the Spirit is saying tonight to the churches. Jesus saying, "Let him who has ears to hear, hear." Now, that's what your ears are for, if they're to hold up your earrings, or if they're to hold on your glasses. Maybe you have ears for something else. But in divine cynicism, he says, if you have ears to hear, then hear. And then he says, "He that hath not," "to him that hath shall more be given, and to him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away." And it's in context of, he that has ears to hear, to him shall more be given. In other words, it's an attitude of heart. He that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away. And God is saying to them here, because of their stubbornness and the struggling with them through the wilderness journey, the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive, or eyes to see, or ears to hear unto this day. Because they had constantly said, "You brought us out here to die. You don't care about us. You're going to kill us in the wilderness." They made the golden calf. I mean, one thing after another, all of the journey, they had bucked the system, and they had cried out against God, and they had complained, and God is looking and says, you don't have in your inclination at this point, even now, a heart to see or to perceive or ears to hear unto this day. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you. Isn't that great? Same clothes, 40 years. Thy shoe is not waxen old upon thy foot. And how could they see that and not perceive it? He says, you haven't perceived. I would realize that if I could go 40 years without buying my kids sneakers, I would realize my budget would be doing great. I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. There it is again, verse 5, that's where we are. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you, your shoe is not waxen old upon thy foot. You have not eaten bread, neither have you drunk wine or strong drink, that you might know that I am the Lord your God. He gave them manna from heaven. He provided for them their food, their clothing, their shoes, caring for 2 million people in the wilderness. Just think of the logistics of that. What that would be, millions of dollars a day. God never had a problem to sustain them. You know, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians. He says, "Moreover, brethren, I would not have that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They did all eat that same spiritual food. They did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, neither be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all of these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. You know, what it's saying here is the God that spoke thousands of years ago to the nation of Israel, and for them, imagine hearing this for the first time, that he's the same tonight. And the same message, and the same voice, and the same pathos on his part, and the same exhortation, that God is the same, and that maybe for you it's just a page or a series of pages in the book of Deuteronomy. But what God's saying is that it should all be very real. It should be his voice speaking again tonight. All of those things are for you. They're all recorded for you. They're all spoken for you. That's what he's saying. And he's saying, you know, they saw the miracles in Egypt. They beheld with their eyes. They had those privileges. All of them came to the Red Sea, and in all their grumbling and all their complaining, the Lord didn't turn away from them. All of them passed through the Red Sea and saw the water walled up on either side, saw the miracle of God's deliverance and the Egyptian army destroyed. All of them saw the cloud by day and the fire by night leading them. All of them ate of that spiritual food that fell from heaven. They all drank of that rock that was struck for them. And yet, with all of God's love and all of God's care and all of God's demonstration, they murmured, they complained, they went into sexual sin, to idolatry. And God says, all of these things are written for you. They're examples. Old Testament recorded, Deuteronomy 28 and 29, held up before you upon whom the ends of the world have come, to be examples, that we might learn not to do the things that they did. And that we would remember to walk with the God who set us free from Egypt, as you and I were in bondage to the world. Our first love. You remember what it was like when you first got saved? Man, oh man. I first got saved, my mind was blown. That's because my mind was blown years before I got saved, so it was still blown right after I got saved. I was really in reentry. There's no doubt about that. But I just remember, my mind was blown. I mean, I had been a vegetarian for 3 years before I got saved. My mom was scared to death, worried about me. Hair down my back, practicing yoga. Walk into my room, find me standing on my head in the corner, swallowing rags and pulling them back up again to clean out my stomach. Practicing Raja and Kundalini yoga, trying to raise the power of the serpent up the chakras in my spine, traveling on astral planes. I got saved. My mind was blown when I got saved. I ate a ham sandwich and hot dogs the first day after not eating. You know, I said, this is great. I can say grace and eat whatever I want. You know, people tell you, oh, you're a vegetarian, eat meat, you'll get deathly sick. I didn't get sick at all. I said grace, praise the Lord, and pigged out. I didn't have a single problem. And man, we're a couple of my friends got saved. We got saved at the same time. We told everybody about Jesus, drove everybody out of their minds. We drove everybody out of their minds. People went in the other direction when they saw us coming. So open, so zealous, so ready to believe, you know. Naive, no doubt. Not grounded. But there was still a simplicity and a beauty about all of that. Leaving tracks everywhere, stuffing them in people's lunches, you know, just, you know. Oh, because we had remembered Egypt. We remembered what it was like to be set free from Pharaoh. We remembered the great sea that God parted in front of us, move us from one part of life to a completely different part of life. Remember the way that he fed us with spiritual food that we had never known. And that he quenched our thirst, you know, like the woman at the well. When Jesus said, I'll give you water to drink. When you drink of it, you'll never thirst again. And how all of us were able to drink from that spiritual rock. What a blessing it was. And how early on, you know, so much zeal in our lives. And yet it seems as the years go by, somehow we allow ourselves to cool. Somehow we become theologically right. We become dead right. Somehow we write little clauses into the contract. Oh yeah, I'm mature now. I can have 3 or 4 glasses of wine. I get a little buzz, but hey, I'm under grace. I'm not under the law. Yes, I sleep with my girlfriend, but we're getting married in God's eyes. We're married already. Oh, cut me a break. What a bunch of baloney. Your problem is you're carnal. You're living in sin. You've left your first love. And you've forgotten all the incredible benefits of being set free from sin and death. And what it was like. Then we were close to the contrast. We were close to that black backdrop that, you know, that Christ had pulled us out of and set us free from. And somehow, you know, how we cool sometimes as the years go on. And how he beckons us. You know, I mean, Kathy and I in our marriage, we don't want it to cool as the years go on. And look, there are responsibilities. We first got married. We were hippies. All we had was each other. Now we have a mortgage. We have a lease on a car. We have four children. We have specialists. Ear, nose, and throat specialist, and this specialist, and we have, you know, there's no doubt all of these complications that come with life, and it was much simpler then. But somehow, as the years have gone by, you know, and you look at each other and you realize, hey, we've come this far, you know. There's a beauty to this. You know, the kids grow up and move out. Wouldn't it be great if the Lord tarries to just be two old people sitting on a porch in rocky chairs looking at each other saying, we made it. We did it. You know, we did it the right way. We did it the way that it pleased the Lord. You know, isn't there, you know, there's kind of a beauty to it. And I think as we go on with Him, we have that advantage too. Yes, we take our side journeys. We find the compromise in our lives. We think it's more spiritual to chase the Holy Ghost of this church and that, and they're laughing over here, and the oil's dripping from the ceiling over here, and we need this over here, and they're laughing over here. And somehow in our long journeys, He brings us back to the cross. And He brings us back to the love of Christ. He brings us back to the blood that first washed us, to the simple beauty of our relationship with Jesus Christ, and we realize there is no greater depth than what I knew when I was first saved. No greater place to walk. And He's saying to the children of Israel, in light of all of these blessings and cursings, He's saying, look, this is all a matter of the heart. You saw what I did to Egypt on your behalf. You saw how I parted the sea to bring you out. You saw how I fed you and cared for you. You saw it with your own eyes. You saw my love displayed everywhere you looked. You saw my care in an impossible journey. You saw me provide where no one else could provide. All of this is done for you. All of that, He's saying to them, should be those things that motivate you in regards to this challenge to obey and to walk with me.